Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where we talk about an episode of The Muppet Show 45 years after its original broadcast. And this week, we'll be discussing the Dom DeLuise episode, which aired in New York City on October 14th, 1977, after having been produced in early August of that same year. This is production number 11, and Dom DeLuise is at an interesting point in his career in terms of what kind of a profile he has as a guest star. It's less clear and obvious as to why he's on the show than, say, other guests that we've had in terms of things they were promoting, reasons they were there, or whether they were at a particular arc. He's actually much more like a first season guest star, in my opinion.
Interesting. I don't know a lot about Dom DeLuise, but I'm familiar with him because I've seen a lot of things that he's been in. But I have no concept of the timeline of his career.
Yep, makes sense.
So, for example, I know Smokey and the Bandit is after this.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say that to you and I, most of what we know about his career is post-Muppet Show. And so this is an interesting window into perhaps what his reputation was that then built to when he became sort of omnipresent in the 80s. But let's therefore give you a little bit of that context.
Jumping right in, I see.
Jumping right into the trivia, because I have five prepared questions about the career of Dom DeLuise that I'm going to ask Pete. And then using those points towards a possible minifig acquisition, will then use that as a jumping point to talk about his involvement in this episode. We'll then talk about how that intersects with the backstage runner, and then go through any sketches that haven't been talked about before concluding with statistics and our five favorite moments in the show. So, Pete, are you ready for trivia?
Let's do it.
Question number one. Dom DeLuise was born in Brooklyn in 1933 to Italian-American Roman Catholic parents. After his death in 2009, archivist Nat Segaloff worked with his family members to organize his collection of photographs, archives, and correspondence. That trove of paperwork and documents is now split between the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in L.A. and the American Comedy Archive at Emerson College in Boston. Which Boston area college did DeLuise attend for his undergraduate studies? A. Boston College. B. Emerson College. C. Tufts University.
I know Emerson has a comedy degree. I doubt they had that when he went, if he went there. I'm going to say Emerson.
I was hoping you would get distracted by the Roman Catholic and Boston College connection. But no, he went to Tufts.
Boo!
Question number two. DeLuise did not write a formal memoir, unlike some of our previous guests, but he did write two cookbooks featuring anecdotes about his career, his upbringing, his family, and his celebrity friends. Eat This, It'll Make You Feel Better was published in 1987, and Eat This Too, It'll Also Make You Feel Better was written in 1997. In it, he writes that he was the very first guest on the Merv Griffin Show in 1961. What recipe does he associate with that appearance? A fat-free, hearty mushroom barley soup recipe that he got from Griffin's wife, Julanne. B. A gazpacho that he and his wife ate while he was booking early work prior to that appearance. Or C. A puttanesca or harlot sauce that he associates with the show that he was hawking on Merv Griffin, The Entertainers, with Bob Newhart and Carol Burnett.
A.
That's correct.
Yes.
the memoir slash recipe book is fascinating in that it doesn't have a narrative. It's organized like a recipe book. And so with each recipe, he will say, oh, I got this from Lonnie Anderson, and here's a nice story about her. And so it jumps all over the place, and it's sort of like hanging out with a person in their kitchen, and they're just telling you stories while they make stuff. Question number three. Which of the following recipes from Eat This has a strange parallel with your own dietary novelties or predilections? A. Much like your beloved cake in a jar, Deloise has a death by chocolate cake in a coffee can recipe, where empty 1 pound coffee cans substitute for cake pans. B. Much like your famous single ingredient ice cream bread, Deloise has a beer bread recipe from his niece's husband that consists of 1 can of beer, 2 tablespoons of sugar, and self-raising flour. Or C. Much like your allergy to chicken proteins, Deloise tells a harrowing story of his father failing to execute a pair of chickens in their Brooklyn apartment that results in a headless chicken running around gushing blood that has prevented him from ever eating it again. So all of his poultry recipes have substitutions of rabbit as well. C. There is a poultry rabbit substitution, and the chicken story is real, but
the fact that he doesn't eat chicken is not.
Is fabricated. The real thing is the beer bread.
I was gonna go with that, but the chicken one was too specific to know was not real. It had too many things in it, so I was like, that's gotta be it. How dare you, trickery.
Question number four. One of Deloise's early film breaks was a movie that is in the top 50 films with the longest title. For reference, Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Glorious Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan, is the 20th longest title at 72 characters. Which of these films is Deloise actually in? A. Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines, or How I Flew from London to Paris in 25 Hours 11 Minutes from 1965, which is 85 characters. B. The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed Up Zombies from 1964 with 72 characters. Or C. Who is Harry Kellerman and Why Is He Saying Those Terrible Things About Me from 1971 with 62 characters.
A.
Unfortunately, it's Harry Kellerman. One of his early, slightly major roles, one of those transitional periods where people started to know who he was. I wanted to have a bonus question.
I need all the points I can get.
To ask you the following. Deloise had made a minor cachet for himself in appearing regularly with collaborators. He was in a number of films with his good friend Burt Reynolds, Cannonball Run, Smokey and the Bandit, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. He was a huge contributor to Don Bluth's animated specials, appearing in Secret of Nim, American Tail, and All Dogs Go to Heaven. And he was a multiple collaborator with Mel Brooks, appearing in Silent Movie as one of the three main parts, and is in both Spaceballs and Robin Hood Men in Tights in small parts. And I was going to ask you, of those three collaborators, Mel Brooks, Burt Reynolds, and Don Bluth, with whom did he collaborate the most?
I'm going to say Don Bluth.
But unfortunately, it's a tie between Burt Reynolds and Mel Brooks, so I couldn't really ask it as a question.
I hate you so much.
It was 6 with Reynolds. He was also in The End and All Dogs Go to Heaven and both Cannonball Runs. Mel Brooks, he was also in 12 Chairs, Blazing Saddles, and History of the World Part 1. And Don Bluth, his complete list is Secret of Nim, American Tail, Troll in Central Park, All Dogs Go to Heaven, and Five-O Goes West. He then made 3 additional movies that were sequels to those movies, but they weren't Don Bluth productions.
How dare you?
As always, we close my trivia segments by asking Pete 6 degrees of Jim Henson or The Henson Connection.
Or 60 seconds of silence.
Pete, Dom DeLuise's top 4 best known for on IMDb are The Secret of Nim with Derek Jacobi, Shannon Doherty, Will Wheaton, and Elizabeth Hartman. Blazing Saddles with Cleveland Little, Gene Wilder, Madeline Kahn, Harvey Korman, and Mel Brooks. All Dogs Go to Heaven, with Burt Reynolds, Lonnie Anderson, Ken Page, and Charles Nelson Reilly. And Cannonball Run, with Burt Reynolds, Farrah Fawcett, Jackie Chan, Sammy Davis Jr., and Adrian Barbeau. With 60 seconds, can you remember earlier versions of this quiz, starting now?
The answer is vaguely, because I remember to go through Mel Brooks. Because Mel Brooks is in the Muppet movie?
Are you asking?
Yeah.
I think you have to say. You have to declare.
Mel Brooks is in the Muppet movie.
That's correct.
Oh, yay! Too right.
Now, if I'd left Mel Brooks off and just said Madeline Kahn and Harvey Korman, could you have remembered that they connected to Mel Brooks and that Mel Brooks was in the Muppet movie?
Before you said Mel Brooks and you said Harvey Korman, I went, oh no, I know I'm supposed to be able to get from Harvey Korman, but I don't remember how.
I've been deliberately not hanging an autographed picture of Mel Brooks in the Muppet movie here on the wall on my autographed Muppet photo wall because you have mystically failed to remember this small trivia detail, and I felt like it was too much of a cheating example to put it there for you to see. Jim Henson's arm and Mel Brooks in the same photograph. But I think we might have gotten to the part where you'll actually remember this next time.
No.
All right, so I still can't hang that photo.
I mean, you can. I would appreciate it if you did. I remember Michelle Pfeiffer, and maybe now I'll remember Mel Brooks.
That's what we're going for. The fun one that I made a connection in here is that Farrah Fawcett, who's in Cannonball Run with Dom DeLuise, is in Logan's Run with Peter Ustinov, who's in The Great Muppet Caper with Jim Henson.
Yeah, never would have remembered that. I
I know that The Great Muppet Caper isn't your go-to film, but Peter Ustinov's scene in The Great Muppet Caper is one of my go-to moments.
Which we talked about, I believe, on the Peter Ustinov episode.
That's correct.
See, I remember that we talked about it. Do I remember the specifics about any of it? Mm. Absolutely not.
With regard to DeLuise's career, this is in the heart of his Mel Brooks run.
Mm-hmm.
This is right when he was doing Blazing Saddles and Silent Movie. And so it wasn't the explosive part of his career that I think really happened in his legendary collaborations with Burt Reynolds, which were more in the early to mid-80s. Also in the mid-80s was when he did two ad campaigns, which, according to his author bio in his book, were the things that brought him most frequently into everyone's home. He was the pitch man for PCs. He was basically the Justin Long of PCs. And there were the same kind of print ad campaigns that it was like Dom DeLuise doing something goofy with relationship to demonstrate how this PC could help you in terms of doing your finances or simplifying your life and doing all this stuff.
Hmm.
But he was also the spokesperson for Ziploc bags.
Nice.
Which I think also had to do with the fact that at that point in his career, he was starting to become known as the funny food guy. Mm-hmm. And was writing these cookbooks and appearing on variety shows and cookery shows. And there was one particular moment where there was a celebrity chef that he did an impression of and showed up at his restaurant pretending to be him and challenging him and saying, I'm the real you, you're an imposter. It was a good bit that people got behind.
Yeah, he's a funny man.
Funny man, legendary comedian, but how did he come across in this episode?
I think really strong. He's just having a blast the entire time.
So one of the sketches that he does in this is basically a Harvey Korman sketch from the first season.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing where he's working for what he claims is a place to rehouse abandoned, lost rescue animals that are giant monster Muppets. And he works himself into a frenzy trying to make sure that they're not violent monsters that are going to attack him.
This lovely creature has to be fed occasionally, otherwise he gets very, very irritated. Here you go. Beautiful. Here you go. Have a nice little snack. What a dog. All better, all better.
And he runs around doing that until everything falls apart and they burst through and grab him. It's actually kind of It's one of the first legitimate creepy moments with Muppet monsters, who almost always subvert their creepiness and come back around to being fluffy and goofy, sort of Snuffleupagus in there. But this literally ends with him being grabbed, potentially eaten, and cuts away from that with no resolution, except the fact that we know that it's fictional.
While he pleads with us to please adopt these animals.
Because they're going to kill him. His attitude, however, is very up. Mm-hmm. When things are happening to him that are bad, he's like Avery Schreiber, but more so. Schreiber was goofy, but depressed. Corman was low energy and depressed. And so now I think we finally have the sketch comedian that's high energy and goofy. And it's a good fit with the Muppets.
Yeah, he is, especially in that sketch. He's only frustrated because he's overwhelmed. He's not frustrated with the Muppets themselves.
He's not annoyed with their persona or behavior or essence.
Just that he can't take care of them well enough. Mm-hmm. So he's more annoyed at himself than he is at them.
But what about with the Kuzbanians? Do you feel like he's similarly where it's a thing where they're annoying him, or is it more the circumstances?
At first, it is, yes, he's annoyed by them, but because of the way it ends with him joining them and being really pumped about it, again, I think it takes that turn where now he's happy. Where when they were smacking him with the hammer or breaking his radio, then he didn't like that, which is why he was trying to attack them. But then once he falls in the pit and becomes one of them, he's all about it.
But also, I think what you're saying is right, is that it's not that he's inherently mad that they exist. It's that they do something to him that affects his ability to return to the ship. It's frustration because they've acted negatively towards him, as opposed to your very existence annoys the hell out of it. But you're right. The ending, unlike the ending with the monsters, where it does end on a note of peril, that a child wouldn't necessarily be able to distinguish that it's not perilous. Mm-hmm. The ending with the transformation into a Kuzbanian is basically him and another Kuzbanian looking at each other and laughing like madmen. It's very clearly, we're having a good time here.
Also, both of those sketches, oddly musical.
I'm not sure I noticed. Talk to me.
I counted at the very beginning, before he walks on stage, it starts with the Murglodops popping up very rhythmically with a bedding of music underneath it.
Murglodop. Murglodop.
So I counted that bedding as music.
Because they're doing their whistles and chants to basically a backing track.
Yes. And then that happens 3 times throughout the sketch.
Okay.
So I counted each time the music started or they were doing that Murglodop whistle rhythmically. So that happens 3 times throughout the sketch. Similarly, in the animal protection sketch, one of the things he does to appease Sweetums is he plays the ukulele and sings a little couplet. So every time he played the ukulele or sang the couplet, I started the clock and stopped the clock.
So a couple of bars of Ain't She Sweet added up over the course of that sketch.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. He or the monster, because the monster does sing it once. I started the clock and stopped the clock on that. It was a pain. And also then adding all those up, because I did them each one individually. I have one of 0.07 seconds, 0.05 seconds, 0.03 seconds, 0.05 seconds, 0.03 seconds, 0.05 seconds. All logged. I'm a madman.
Yeah, but this is a decision you've made for yourself.
And I'm quite happy about it.
Okay. So, much in the way in which I was thinking earlier about making a comment about the idea that, sure, once he's been transmogrified into a Kuzmanian, he is going to laugh along and say, ha-ha, this was wonderful, much like a cult experience. You yourself, having made this terrible decision for yourself, now can't admit that it was a bad idea.
Because it wasn't a bad idea, it was a great idea.
That's right.
I'm trapped in this prison. Please help.
Please adopt me.
Yes. Please send donations or adopt me. Donations preferable.
Well, let's, having given some broad strokes about Don DeLuise, let's talk about the segments specifically that he appears in and the way in which it interacts with the backstage segments. So, like most of this season, all of this season so far, the episode begins with a guest star in the dressing room backstage before the title sequence. Scooter comes on to say there are 18 seconds to curtain, and then there's a cut to DeLuise's head on a platter with lettuce on top of his bald dome and an apple in his mouth as he's being prepared by the Swedish chef. Pete, this is way too short to be 18 seconds.
He says 18 seconds to curtain 6 seconds into the episode.
Okay.
They're only 3 seconds off because the cut to the curtain is 15 seconds in, and he said 18. So it's the closest we've been.
I felt certain that something was missing from this sketch, that there was supposed to be a line or something said there, because it's a strange, choppy sequence from 18 seconds to curtain, Mr. DeLuise, to nothing but a pan and mumbles.
Yeah, because the first thing you actually see is the Swedish chef putting the apple in his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like there was supposed to be a line there. And
that he was getting cut off from saying.
Yeah.
And that extra half a line could have made it actually get to, or an earlier cut from the revelation that his head is on a platter. If there'd been a line leading up to the apple stuff, then you could have cut away sooner. I really felt like whatever they had didn't land, and so they stretched out the other half until it got as close to 18 seconds as possible.
This is not the shortest episode of the season so far,
but
it's the second shortest by 1 second.
In general, I didn't feel like this episode was missing anything until I did a review of the sketches, and I noticed that aside from Veterinarian's Hospital and an Electric Mayhem, there isn't really a lot of standard Muppet sequences in this. And that upon noticing that, I missed them. I wished that there had been at least one more regularly occurring segment in here, just to make it feel more Muppet Show-esque.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, it didn't feel short. Like when I got to the end of it, I was like, oh, well, I was missing something. It was only when doing a tally, I was like, oh, huh. It would have been nice to have one more checklist of a regular bit.
This season so far has felt very fast-paced, I agree with you, because every time it fades to that black, I am amazed because it doesn't feel like it's been any time at all. I think that's largely due to the intertwining of the storylines, because it just feels like it's clipping. It's not just like, oh, here's a song. Oh, here's the first guest song. Oh, here's a sketch that may or may not be related to the guest. It's making it feel like it's going at a quick pace.
It's not as choppy, and therefore it's not as noticeably fragmented. And so you're going with the flow. After the standard opening, we then have Miss Piggy doing a musical number of a song that's variously called My Old Man Said Follow the Van or Don't Dilly Dally on the Way. And this is a return to the music hall performance setup that we saw, well, we've seen twice earlier, but specifically in the Rich Little episode where we had the ability to see Piggy in full body in Boy in the Gallery. It's the same basic camera setups and look of her standing in the middle of the stage performing to the whole Muppet audience.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another song from 1919, was performed by music hall celebrity Mary Lloyd, who made Boy in the Gallery famous. I really did go back and check the dress to see if they just potentially even shot it on the same time. But it is a different outfit for the Muppet. and also the production dates indicate that it was done later.
Was the Rich Little episode, because I don't remember, also Philip Casson?
You know what? I didn't pay attention to who directed this.
This was a Philip Casson episode.
I'm pretty sure the Little One was, yes.
So that would lead credence to that theory of like, okay, this is what I did last time. Because similar to that music hall episode, mm-hmm. the audience also joins in this one very enthusiastically, starting with Statler and Waldorf, and then with the second chorus that she says, I'm not going to sing this again, so sing if you want to.
It does feel like an extension of that setup, because we were sort of interested in the fact that the audience joined in and it was a pleasant thing that Statler and Waldorf didn't have anything bad to say about it. And that's what happens here, too, except that leads into the reveal of Kermit and Scooter standing in the wings, being impressed with how successful this was. And then once Kermit leaves, it's revealed between Piggy and Scooter that this was them paying the audience to be in favor of her performance.
To make Kermit notice her more. Piggy also does say kissy kissy.
Yes, she does. I think this might be the only catchphrase that we'll need to track this season.
Because it's more of a Frank thing than a Jack Burns thing.
Yes, although the only time I remember hearing kissy kissy prior to this so far this season is from Rich Little. He did it when he did the Piggy impression. The switch from the wings shot to the backstage shot has Scooter and Piggy further figuring out how much of a plot this is, how much of the money is involved, and the basic tension seems to be, as you say, Piggy is trying to get Kermit to notice her more.
But I am only doing this in order for the frog to notice me more.
Sure. Sure. And if you happen to get your own spot on the show, well, that wouldn't hurt.
Therefore, it makes it seem like this is just about the frog's affections. But as the sketch develops, it actually is more about contract stuff than it is about notice me. Because the ploy that they come up with later is, I'm going to go to a different show.
Yeah, I think that's how it just backfires on her, though. Because I do think it's intended for him to notice her and not trying to get more money out of it. And that's just the other way that she could make him
feel that she's valuable.
Yes, that if she leaves, oh no, she won't be around and I'll miss her that way, not only on the show, but in real life.
But unfortunately, that's not really how it comes across in subsequent sketches.
Because Kermit doesn't feel that way, so I think he
therefore, because he doesn't naturally feel that way, just turns it into business.
Yes.
But there's no real writing of her trying to zig it back into the personal until she, as we'll get to, eventually breaks down and cries.
Yes. As Ice-T says, famously, it's not personal, it's business.
I should have seen that one coming. Scooter promises to continue with the campaign of deception and zooms off stage. Piggy has a moment where she goes directly to camera in this. It ends with her saying, you know the words that you need to use.
Gorgeous, beautiful, modest.
And modest is delivered directly to camera.
Hmm.
So it's one of two camera moments in the episode that continues to muddy the what is this show anyway. There's a third one that's weird, and I'll address it when we get to it.
After that, Kermit introduces Dom's first segment, saying that he's on the planet Coosbane, and we've already briefly discussed this, but is there anything else you wanted to touch on? There's lots of
little bits in here that we didn't really discuss, so we can get into the weeds if we want to. Well, yeah, let's address a couple of the specifics in that it begins with, as you say, a musical track and whistles and these Kuzmanian creatures who say the word Myrladop as they come up out of the craters.
Myrladop.
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 Myrladop. Myrladop.
Myrladop.
And they're constructed basically like a hairy cone-shaped beaker. They have the same scoop upward mouth that juts out as they talk. They are scared when he appears. He's doing a Star Trek riff in that he's on the planet. It's a star date. He's waving to them and doing some good patter, some excellent subversion of the Star Trek trope, sort of banal stuff that he's talking about on the surface.
Hold it. I see some Cools Quartz. Hold on.
Oh, Jane, keep that soup warm for me, sweetheart.
I have a question about what he's saying there.
Yeah.
He sees a rock, says, I think I found a beauty. He takes a hammer to the set, breaks off a piece of it, and says,
oh, I think I found a beauty. Oh, no, no, no. It's an Emmy. Never mind.
I-M-M-I. Mm-hmm. Never mind. And then throws it. What's an Emmy?
I don't know. I was more weirded out by what the mineral was in the first place. Because I heard him say, I heard something quartz, but it's mumbled. The subtitles violently disagreed with me in that interpretation. They did what, as far as I can tell, is a made-up word that does not sound at all what he was saying. C-A-U-C-R-O-I-S. Cocroy. Which is not what he's saying. But I'm pronouncing it in a French way, and maybe if you didn't pronounce it in a French way, it would make more sense. As banter goes, it could just be they're coming up with fake sci-fi terms for things and sort of blowing it off. Or it could be these are references that I don't understand, and I'm not sure which.
Mm. According to the transcript on the fandom page, he says, I see some Coos Quartz.
Aha!
So, Kuzbanian quartz.
That makes so much more sense. Couldn't figure out the first syllable.
But this does also say the line that I had a question. Oh, they have an editor's note. They say that Emmy is short for imitation.
Huh.
So, he thinks he found a beauty piece of Kuz quartz. Oh, no, 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 no.
It's fake.
It's an Emmy.
That sounds interpretive to me. I think they're trying to put a spin on it.
But it makes sense. Emmy, imitation, and then he throws it away because it's
fake.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if he's prying it out of the ground, how can it be imitation Goose Quartz? Well, because they're on a set?
Could be. Or it could be a fool's gold situation, which is something that looks like gold but is in fact not.
That's the best no prize version of that interpretation I could also come up with. But there's no textual evidence for it. It's just that makes a certain amount of sense within the action of the fake world that we're trying to expand.
Looking up Emmy and slang on Urban Dictionary.
Well, that sounds dangerous.
Yeah. The entry says I-M-M-I, but the definition says I-M-M-I-E.
Makes sense.
Is simply short for amazing. So it's definitely not that.
But as you say, having decided that for whatever reason it has no value, he tosses it in one of the craters and it produces a jet of steam and the whistle, which then gets him to investigate. And as he's peeking in to look at it, the Kuzbanians, the Merlinodops, whatever they're called, come out of the craters and start doing their little dance again. And one of them grabs the hammer, and then as they come out of the crater, it turns out that whatever one of them has, multiple of them have, because he gets hit on the knee with the hammer, and then another one comes out of another crater and hits him on the knee while the other one is still going back down into the crater. So three of them have hammers, despite the fact that there was only one hammer. So there's some sort of dimensional portal weirdness going on in this that is finally even better revealed by the fact that when he's reaching down into the crater to try and get one, his arm comes up out of a different crater, stretched beyond normal human limits. And then when he pulls it back, he's got a dead arm and he can't get it to work. So he can't signal the mothership to come and get him. Frustrated, he falls into the hole and then, as you said earlier, becomes a happy Myrtleodop.
And says, Myrtleodop, with a big smile on his face.
And one of the Frankos Myrtleodops looks at him and they all go, wah, 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 wah.
This was another example of, you can hear him cracking up the crew as well.
Yes.
Because some of the laughs are legit crew laughs, not the
additional put in afterwards laughs.
Yeah.
Very clearly, I wouldn't at all be surprised if most of the audio for this is just real in the raw laughter.
While we're talking about this, after it's done, Statler and Waldorf do discuss if they believe there's life on any other planets. Mm.
You suppose they have any life on other planets?
What do you care? You don't have any life on this one.
the next time we see Dom, it crosses over with our backstage runner because Piggy runs into Dom's dressing room to change because hers is full of flowers.
His is also starting to overflow with her flowers. He's irritated about the fact that he's not getting anything. All he's been received so far is a small basket of fruit.
Which, after looking at the basket, is also for Piggy.
She's changing behind a screen and referring to him as my dear Dominique in a overly French accent, which basically everything about Piggy is annoying him. She's getting attention. He's the guest star. He feels like he should be getting attention. Therefore, he disagrees with our theory that the Muppets should be the stars and the guests should just intersect with their storylines.
Mm-hmm.
He feels like the guests should be the main characters and the Muppets should support him in his moment of stardom. She pries herself out of a girdle to a great springing noise, and it flies over the screen. There are a couple of fat-shaming jokes.
Between both of them, so it's not just one way.
I mean, obviously the girdle is the first reference to the idea that there might be some fat shame going on that's being repressed. But then she calls him Chubbo, and he says that you are one to talk. Nobody's coming off well in this exchange.
And then after saying you're one to talk, he then says something along the lines of, well, why don't you not, or something like that, and stuffs an apple in her mouth, like he started the episode with.
Which made me, since I was already suspicious of the opening having not gone according to plan, made me dislike the opening even more, because they were reusing a joke they just used less than 10 minutes ago.
I didn't mind the mirrored nature of that, of he starts with it in an image that you wouldn't expect to see a pig's head on the platter with the thing, and then Piggy ends up with that. But I wouldn't be surprised if that line was basically the same joke twice. And so they cut that part of it and were like, well, the image is still funny.
That we're treating our guest star so badly in the opening.
Yeah.
That whole opening just feels less and less connected to everything else that's going on in the episode, the more the episode continues. He never refers to it. He's not in threat or worried about his life or his safety. It doesn't connect to this jealousy that's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
But the conflict between Piggy and Deloise ends because Scooter comes in saying that Piggy needs to get ready for Vet's hospital. And
she says, no problem. I'm more than happy to provide you with a patient.
That's what it is. My handwriting says, makes me think, here's your first patent. But I know there's a high written after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't figure out what was going on. And the sketch has a very strange but wonderfully toned ending where, having just hit him and left abruptly, he's now talking either to himself or basically to camera.
She's out of her mind! I've never seen anybody so crazy!
And then starts stress eating a banana.
Also, for the record,
uh-huh,
she hayas him. She does two hits and a kick.
Correct.
But unlike the previous quote-unquote kicks we've seen, which have been more stomps, her leg comes up from under frame and gets him and then goes back down. So this is the first time we've seen like a karate kick on camera from her.
It is a good escalation of the physicality of the puppet, that they're doing more things in order to have her seem more three-dimensional and real.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that Dom does after the hi-ya could have been cut and thrown away. Like, there's no real purpose to it. It's not an actual punchline. It's barely a button because it doesn't really connect. He's not saying or setting up an additional joke. He's just complaining. And the fact that he's stress eating connects to the earlier fat shaming argument between the two of them. But again, it's not connected linguistically. It's just behavioral.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very effective, but it's interesting how not writerly it is. It's not structurally done to be funny. It's just because he's doing it in a funny, naturalistic way.
Yeah, it's not a joke, but it is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite performance of his. I think the stuff that he does in the Coos Bane stuff is delightful and wonderful. But it is interesting that they chose to keep it and that he did it in the first place, because it is a completely different tone of everything else they do.
I wonder if it was an improv that they kept.
I wouldn't at all be surprised.
That it was supposed to just be he falls down, she goes away, and but then he popped up, did that, and everyone's like, hey. You got us, Dom.
Vet's Hospital is a continuation of the escalation of the Piggy popularity plot, or the PPP, as we like to call it.
Don't default on those loans, though. Make sure you're using 75% of it for the payroll.
And during the normal time which Piggy would be messing around with the equipment, the camera pans past equipment that nobody is touching or using and gets to Dr. Bob and Janice without her being there. And that's when we start to hear that the audience is chanting, "We want Piggy. We want Piggy." You want me to keep going? I figured that was a good place to pass it off.
Nah, I could have listened to you say "We want Piggy" for at least three or four more times. Because we all want Piggy. But yes, she then enters through the double swung doors and the crowd goes wild.
There's a cut to the crowd in this. At this point or at the end of the sketch?
I think at the end of the sketch. Okay. But I could be wrong on that. I did not, even though I usually keep track of audience shots, I did not make a note.
I think it's both. I think we get a crowd shot here as they're chanting, and then we get the, during, that helps with the flowers throwing, we get a crowd shot at the very end. You have been irritated by the glassy-eyed guru in these crowd shots in the past.
Didn't bring it up earlier, when the crowd sings.
How's he reacting to you this time?
He's the same glassy-eyed freak show as he has been. But going back, since we brought it up, in the Don't Dilly Dally on the Way song, when the audience is singing along, he is not.
That's right.
His mouth is still unmoving as he just, yet again, turns back and forth with his glowing weird eyes. There's also a chicken dead center frame that never moves. At least the guru is moving.
I paid, because you brought it up before, extra attention to the guru and therefore missed the chicken. I wasn't distracted by any aspect of his eyes. Like, they didn't bother me at all. Because right behind him is the little girl from the Svengali sketch from last season, where they do the Marlena Dietrich song, "You Do Something to Me."
Mm-hmm.
She has the same shaped mouth as the Myrtleanops, by the way. And she's really creepy. She's doing a thing where she's sort of doing the guru thing of looking back and forth, but her eyes are big and wide and weird, and I was just like, that's a weird head, and I can't not look at it.
Well, write in, audience, with which Muppet character you find more unsettling.
Tag yourself. Which Muppet audience member that's being half-controlled by a guest Muppeteer who's probably not getting credited are you?
We'll have one of those Instagram filters
right
up on our non-existent, no longer exists Instagram page for you to put on your stories, dear listeners.
We have seen who the patient in Vet's Hospital is prior to Piggy even arriving.
It's true. And Animal Watch. It's an animal.
That's right. It is a classic Sesame Street cow, same as we had in the Twiggy episode.
Oh.
And the cow is on the operating table, and we get a couple of classic herd of cows, bunch of cows puns.
Milk, moo, anything you can think of that are related to cows, they make a bad pun about it.
They don't. They utterly left one off the table.
I've hit stop on the record. I don't know how the audience is hearing this right now. I'm done. Well played.
But yes, it ends with the announcer pitching to Piggy to get the final line, and she says that it's a moving experience. At this point, we have the flowers thrown on and Piggy doing lots of thank yous to the huge cheers and the utter befuddlement of Rolf and Janice.
I'm not giving you it twice.
That wasn't a pun.
You said utter, though, again.
Not intended. Should have waited for it, but not intended.
So it's not murder one, it's just manslaughter.
It's Myrtle-a-dop one.
Ooh, I like that. That I'm not mad about at all.
And then we have a fade to black.
The next time we have one of the runners or Dom is another backstage segment. Mm-hmm. Scooter and Piggy are doing a very poorly put on quote-unquote show for Kermit about what you mentioned earlier about Piggy getting an offer from another show for double the money.
Well, you are a superstar.
Oh, no, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
Kermit clearly knows it's fake. As soon as Piggy disappears into her dressing room, he just walks up to Scooter and goes, yeah, I know that was fake.
Says, that was terrible, and Scooter gives up the game by saying, no, I thought I did a pretty good job, except for that one line I muffed. Oh.
Yeah, and then Scooter sings like a canary, knowing that he's...
But he sings like a canary because Kermit offers to increase his pay. Now,
which, as we know, is already exorbitant compared to the rest of the cast.
So, the way this sketch ends is ludicrous with regard to overall Muppet Show continuity, which only underscores the fact that overall Muppet Show continuity doesn't and shouldn't exist. Because, yes, as you say, Scooter's getting paid too much. And so for Kermit to say, I'm glad that you care more about money than being faithful to the show by saying,
I'll give you a raise.
The flowers are fake. The audience was paid off. I wrote the fan letters and Miss Piggy doesn't have another offer.
Scooter, I like your style.
It's insane. It's not at all how Kermit should be responding to the circumstance.
Now, to be fair, they do not agree on a price. So this might be a negligible raise. It might be a penny.
I assume that that is Kermit deliberately manipulating by saying you'll get a raise and then having not specified terms giving him the most minimal raise possible. That is what I would do in Kermit's shoes because Kermit is the worst manager. He's only betraying both his pig star, with whom he has a ludicrously unprofessional relationship, and his gopher, who has been foisted upon him by a megalomaniacal, controlling theater owner. But for him to like that style is the worst. Therefore proving Kermit is not great.
But he's very cute.
Oh, he's Trey Adorbs. All of the women guest stars have told us so. The following sketch is a guest star sketch, and it's a classic guest star sketch, much like we saw a lot in the first season, where we have a completely hypothetical scenario. The guest is playing a character in a scene, and it's just a sketch like on a sketch show. And everybody's doing bits, and that's the only way, as we talked about, since this is the Shepherd's Institute for Animal Protection, and it's a telethon. And Dom DeLuise is addressing the camera directly and the audience through it, trying to raise money to take care of these animals who need help. But the animals do not need help. They need to be coaxed and kept calm or else they're going to destroy things. And the sketch ends with them planning to murderize him.
It's very fun.
If it wasn't being done through the sketch show auspices of we're all playing characters, I do legitimately think that kids would have been like, wait, what? Because obviously there's no reason why he should escape and return later, except for the fact that this is all fabrication. This should have had a backstage segment of them walking off in order to undercut the possible peril.
And especially where the next thing is a backstage segment. Yes, you're absolutely right. It's not like there was something in between this that yeah. then would have prevented that from happening. But no, the next thing we see is Kermit talking to Piggy about knowing, or about the offer, not knowing yet. He's not writing on that.
Yeah, he's doing some busy work. He's doing some business in the foreground, and she comes up and he says, I know about the offer. I overheard, and I don't want to stand in your way. For that much money, go be successful. I'm letting you go.
And she initially goes along with it, trying to hopefully make him one last time come to his senses. But she eventually breaks and begs for her job back. Kermit agrees, but clearly, since she's been spending all this money on roses and paying off audience members and all these other things, that she doesn't need the salary that she used to make, so she's going to have to come back for a pay cut.
Which, what I assumed is the difference between what she's making is what potentially Scooter could be making.
That's true, but I figure Kermit's actually making out on top.
It's all unsaid except for the fact that he quickly escapes before she can do any violence, and it ends with Piggy basically screaming so loud that she gets up in the camera and gets out of focus. This is one of the other moments where it became clear that the camera was real. Like, she... Mm-hmm. is doing the violent Piggy equivalent of a Jim Halpert look, which is screaming directly into camera. And before that, we have the other normal camera bit, which is that while Piggy is trying to get some sympathy from the frog and saying, well, you'll at least tell everybody else that I've left and...
Well, you'll explain to everyone what happened, Kermit?
Oh, sure. What a ham.
And that is not said to himself, that is said to us, the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
He's not putting up with any of her fake drama in this.
Kermit then introduces the final act of the show, and so Dom comes out. And before he even gets started, he invites Piggy on stage because it's clear that she's very upset and he doesn't want her to be upset.
When she comes out, the audience applauds and she tells the audience to cool it, that he knows, meaning the frog, not Deloise. But it's interesting that Deloise is aware of the fact that this has gone badly for Piggy. He's no longer holding a grudge from what was going on in the dressing room about the flowers and everything, and about the violence towards him. He legitimately is like, we need to make sure that she's having a good show. So he's been witness to this. But it is weird that the audience responds... or is about to respond with applause and praise, because if he's saying she's had a bad night, then surely if the audience can see what's going on backstage, they would have known this and wouldn't have been therefore ready to go. Piggy's line doesn't make much sense here is what I'm getting at. I like it, but in terms of the internal logic of the arc of what's going on,
yeah, because
it doesn't hold up to examination.
If he knows,
that's right,
meaning Dom knows, then that's the right. Audience should know, because they heard the same scream that gives up the ghost.
Yep. So I like it as, it's a good reaction for her to have. I like the cut, but it doesn't really make sense.
It could also be that they haven't been paid yet. And if they stop, then maybe Scooter won't hand them the money that they've been promised. So they just keep going.
Or being paid per praise, then they could get one last nickel out of this.
Yeah.
He then tries to tell her that, you know, you should just be appreciative that you're here, because...
Piggy, you're not alone. Look at me a minute. You're here. I'm here. Us is here.
Us is here.
But it's a lead-in to the song We Got Us, which is a song from a 1968 Walter Marx musical called The Golden Rainbow, which has had very little impact or profile. The song that came out of it that's perhaps most well-known is I Gotta Be Me.
Okay, that I've heard of.
Exactly.
I couldn't tell you a single bar from it, but I've...
But you could sort of chant the title in a sing-songy way that's going to be 90% of the correct rhythm of the chorus. Yes,
mm-hmm.
That's basically its legacy. But it allows everybody to come on and sing. We've got a decent cast of characters and one prominently featured, totally random whatnot. And they close out on that number.
We trade our lives for no other. They only got one another, but we...
This song has a very Muppets Take Manhattan vibe to it. The way they stretch out the last syllable of some of the lines towards the end, it reminded me of one of the Muppets Take Manhattan songs that I can't put my finger, that I can't name right now, but...
It's the one that they do at the meeting. Where nobody feels like that feeling.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Together again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that stretched out. You nailed it. I also really liked, at the very end of it, the way they do that staccato, like, and they raise their heads and lower their heads as the song goes up and down.
Dom is slightly out of sync with the Muppets at the very end of that, though. It's a good bit, but unfortunately you need to have an arm stretching out fabric to really do it well, and unfortunately the human can't keep up.
And also to have two Muppets all in on each hand so you can do two synchronously. As the applause rains upon them, Dom does plant one kiss on Piggy.
Ah. No, you're right. Now that you mentioned that, I did focus specifically on that to see if she would grunt. And it doesn't get that far.
No, it is just, he plants one on her and it cuts to black. And we have Kermit calling Dom out from backstage to thank him. And
a big hand for our guest star. Says that he especially wants to thank the audience that was there for the show, not because they were paid off by the pig.
And then Piggy doesn't like that, charges the stage, and is going to hi-ya Kermit, but Dom holds her back as the credits roll and other Muppets come in to say goodbye.
Mill about. To just be there.
Yeah, no one goes to also help hold Piggy back or protect Kermit. No, they're just doing the SNL, like, bye!
And that's basically it for the ongoing narrative of the thing. I think that this was, as you say, a good example of having the guest star and the plot intersect. It wasn't too obvious. My one note of if Dom and the monsters had come backstage after the sketch, you could have had one more brief Piggy-Dom interaction that might have then better fed into him being sympathetic to her in the final number. Because I do feel like his change of heart kind of comes out of nowhere after their interaction in the dressing room.
Yeah.
That's my only punch up in terms of the intertwining of those two things.
I'm doing some extra math here because I'm looking through the rundown of what's left to talk about. And there's three songs. That's it. Which is a total of 3.93 minutes.
Fascinating.
Now, we didn't talk about every Kermit in-between thing. Mm-hmm. I think we may not have talked about one Statler and Waldorf besides the end credits one.
That's correct.
But basically, let's round up and say 4.5 minutes out of this 26-minute episode.
Which is what percentage?
17% of the episode is unrelated to guest or runner.
Huh. And assumedly even less for a U.S. audience.
Yeah, because they wouldn't have gotten Henrietta's Wedding. And we'll talk about it in a minute, but they also wouldn't have gotten Don't Blame the Dynamite.
Really? Don't Blame the Dynamite is kind of fascinating. So let's... I do want to at least talk about the music a little bit. Not just because I did research on it. But it is odd.
Well, why don't we just jump to that since we mentioned it.
And if you ain't been happy lately, don't put it on the blues. Don't blame the dynamite if you can't light the fuse.
Don't Blame the Dynamite is an original Muppet song.
Hmm.
It does not exist outside of the Muppet Show. There's a short list on Fandom of songs that were written specifically for the show. If you do a Google search for it, you will find that it's the title of an album by a jazz fusion group
called Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem.
R.J. Knopp and a woman named Robin that titled their album that. On the Spotify release, they include a cover of Don't Blame the Dynamite. On the Bandcamp release, they don't have the ability to sell it because they didn't have the rights to it. And so it's not part of the recording.
Makes sense, but it's also weird that Spotify would allow it to be up there with them getting paid for it. But
one of its few existences on the web that doesn't have to do with the Muppets is its registry in the Copyright Index, which is July 27th, 1977. So it was literally written less than a month before this production.
Yeah.
And before I figured out that it was an original song just for this show, I was like, that's got to be the smallest window.
How did they find out about this? Did they see the live show premiere of it or something like that? Yeah.
So this is the rough equivalent of the song that was in Sex and Violence.
Mm.
where it's another thing where Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem are doing a song that's about explosions and bombs, and they're relating it to emotions and love.
And my note is, why would you have a song with dynamite in the title and not have Crazy Harry show up? Which would have guaranteed me to be more interested than I actually was.
This was mildly interesting from a filming perspective, because yes, they've created a elaborate set for the Mayhem to perform on, where each of them has a spot in a big rig.
Yeah, and I did like how it wasn't just Dr. Teeth singing. They shared vocals. Everyone had a moment. What I did have a problem with was so often the camera was on a musician who wasn't the main instrument
that
being
you were
featured.
Listening to. Yeah.
So you'd have the organ going, but you'd be on Zoot, who was not actively playing the saxophone. And that was wild to me.
I did notice that a couple of times, maybe not with quite the emphasis that you had. I think that they tended to cut to somebody you'd been hearing. And so I think that there is a narrative logic there of, I've been hearing the sax. Oh, good, now we're cutting to Zoot. But then he would play a little bit before it would cut away from him. So it was almost a jazz resolution of, we're finally ending the tension by showing you what you've been listening to.
But I want to see the Muppet play the thing that I'm listening to.
So then you can complain that it's not
well,
in sync.
Yes, and I would have done that too. So the Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem cannot win. However, in this instance...
Oh my god, he admitted.
In this instance, Philip Casson also can't win, because that's bad directing.
I'm not sure it actually is. I do stand by my idea that if you're listening to it, you want to therefore cut to that because you've been interested in what it's going to be. I think that makes a certain degree of sense in terms of filmmaking.
No. I'm thinking of if this was a live production,
mm-hmm.
if this was the Oscars or whatever, and you have a director
in the booth
saying, cut to camera three, right after...
I'm talking about Tom Cruise does an amazing delivery and then you cut to Cruise in the audience.
Here's what it would be. Here are your nominees.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hanks, you're on the people who just said, here are the nominees. Tom Cruise, as they say Tom Cruise, they go to Tom Hanks. No, you don't do that. If you're hearing the instrument being featured, you show the instrument being played. You don't want to... Anyway, we've talked about this for too long.
You made your argument. Your argument is very clear, and I particularly like the visual example. The other major song is, as you've mentioned, Henrietta's Wedding. Now, I loved researching Henrietta's Wedding. But before we get to that, Henrietta's Wedding is a wild song because the lyrics are...
We've been invited to Henrietta's wedding, though she can't tell us where it will be.
But we don't know when it's going to happen, where it's going to be, or to whom she's getting married. And as the song continues, I'm sitting there thinking, hang on, are the Muppets singing a song about a woman who got knocked up and doesn't know the father?
Mm.
And then you have the female of this folk duo leap forward at the very end and shout,
so does she.
Henrietta's never gonna have a wedding and everybody knows it.
In this wonderfully catty, dare I say bitchy, way of being like, and Henrietta is never gonna be happy. And that makes it less about the weird thing of why would she be having a marriage if we don't know to whom or where, and it seems all very much hurried, and that this might be because she's, quote, in trouble, unquote. And more about, oh yeah, whatever, she's just talking about getting married, but we know nobody's gonna marry her. And I like the fact that I'm pretty sure that line was created by the Muppets in order to move it into a less family awkward direction. Did you have a similar read on that or not?
I didn't go into it to quite that depth.
You weren't doing the Real Housewives of Elm Street Studios.
No, I was just along the ride, similar to the other wordplay songs that we've heard, of, oh, this is just fun, and if I pay attention, there's more to this. Or I can just go, oh, this is catchy. It works on both of those levels.
It's very catchy.
It does go too long, and is, even though it's less than the 2 minutes that a UK spot usually is, because it's too repetitious. Mm. They sing the chorus maybe 5 times.
Not nearly.
It's too many times. But it was fun, and also the Muppets are Slim Wilson and Lou, who was played by Louise Gold. This is her only credit in the fandom page. She's still not credited on.
Yeah, that I noticed. So here's the fun origin of this song. The song is originally performed, as far as I can tell, by Joseph Murray and Miss Miranda. They met because Joseph Murray is South African and Miranda is Dutch, and they met over common language and were doing translation work together when Miss Miranda discovered that he was doing this musician stuff, making a number of collections of anglicized folk music from Africa and around the world. This is on an album called Joseph Murray and Miranda Revisit the South African Veld. And I don't know a whole heck of a lot about South African music, but there's nothing about the instrumentation of this that makes me think African music. And so that in and of itself was bizarre. Murray has said in an interview that he believes that the lyrics come out of Zulu culture and that this is a joke narrative as to what a man would have said in terms of when his wife was like, so wait, where did that money go? And he's like, oh, I spent it on a wedding gift for Henrietta. When is she going to get married anyway? And that this is the catty wife response to that narrative, which doesn't seem to match up with the actual lyrics.
Yeah.
And so it's fascinating that the guy who arranged these lyrics in English from Afrikaans thinks that that's the origin story behind it in terms of... He was a scholar of folk songs. They collected over 10 albums of various folk songs that they did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, where they popularized world folk according to the rising American folk idiom. So they were orchestrating and doing music in a pre-Simon and Garfunkel way in order to make it popular, but with literal folk songs from all over the world. That on this same album is a song called We're Marching to Pretoria, which is a song that the British soldiers sang on their way to the Boer War.
So it's not a song about a man with blades for legs murdering his ex-girlfriend through a bathroom door?
He was springing to Pretoria.
Right.
But that song was covered by the Smothers Brothers later. And I listening to it on the album, I was like, I know this song. I found this song super catchy. Mm-hmm. It is in my idiom. It is the kind of music that I like. But I was also weirded out by the fact that this is transpositional Zulu folk song done by two people who speak Dutch in order to conform to 50s folk pop music.
Yeah, it was fun. I did like it.
Well, that shocks me in and of itself.
I mean, I didn't love it. But compared to the Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem song?
Oh, it's a top 40 hit.
Yeah.
Sorry. Sorry, original Muppet composition writers.
Listen, if Crazy Harry showed up, it would have
changed your rating.
It would have blasted through that roof.
The last musical bit is a second in a row, animal, basically...
Animal on the drums.
A little bit longer than a wipe.
Yeah, it is 23 seconds long.
So this is basically an animal version of a Wayne and Wanda joke.
Yeah, animal's playing a drum solo, and then he finishes and smiles, and then you hear one last note that he didn't play, and he looks behind him and goes, huh? And that's it.
It's a weird bit.
Yeah. They could have cut this and left that Dom DeLuise opening line in, and I would have been perfectly happy.
But I think what I wanted in this was a Muppet Newsflash. I wanted something more traditional, and More Dom DeLuise wouldn't have done that for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was good to have something that was Muppet performers. It was just weird to have an animal segment when we come back from break, we had two songs in a row. We had a song that American audiences didn't see, and then we had the Electric Mayhem. There was always...
Or Nickelodeon audiences didn't see.
Because of bomb metaphors. Or whatever.
Yeah, who knows.
But in general, that aspect of the Muppet Show was covered in this episode. I would have therefore wanted something else instead of the animal bit.
I'm going to go through a real quick rundown, because that makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
So... the animal playing the drums happens after the Kuzbanian sketch.
Okay.
So Kuzbanian sketch, 23 seconds of animal, and then we have the Dom in the dressing room with Piggy.
Okay.
So you need that to break up those segments.
Because we've got otherwise Dom and Dom.
Yeah. And Dom dressed in a wig, laughing his head off, to him sitting in his dressing room all of a sudden.
Right. If he had come into the dressing room and found Piggy there, that could have been a transition, but they did it the way they did it.
Yeah. Then you have Piggy leaving because Scooter calls her to Vet's Hospital. After Vet's Hospital, goes to break, comes back to the UK spot and the song. And then you have Piggy and Scooter backstage doing their poorly rehearsed bit. So if you don't have those three things that aren't related to the show, you literally don't have any. As we discussed earlier, these are the only three things that are not related to either Dom or the Piggy bit.
Because most of the performances, therefore, that the Muppet Show audience sees are Piggy bits.
Yeah.
If we didn't have those musical numbers.
It's just Piggy and Dom.
It's the Piggy Show.
Which leads credence to what Piggy says earlier about...
She should have a regular spot on the show.
Yeah, it seems like this is the Piggy Show. So,
Scooter... Because we don't have...
We don't have Pigs in Space.
Well, I was going to say, we don't have Fozzie bits this season. In the same way we did traditionally of him doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
We've had him do performances, but we haven't had him do Fozzie doing Gags Beasley jokes on stage. We don't have a Gonzo bit this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the other things that come out on stage as performances. But increasingly, we just have Piggy doing music hall acts.
As a matter of fact, looking at it, Gonzo shows up in the final sketch as part of the chorus, but Dave Goles is not credited as Gonzo this episode.
Hmm.
He's only credited in the fandom page as a Murdladop and the Lunch Encounter Monster.
And there's a weird bit with another regular segment that could have been there instead of the animal, would have been a Rolf segment on mm-hmm. the piano. There's a weird bit of when Scooter and Kermit are in the wings watching Piggy, Rolf walks past in the background silently. Of course, because Kermit's in the foreground.
Yeah, although Jim is credited as Rolf in this episode. So that may be an oversight.
Or because of the opening credits.
Oh, true. But yeah, it's a weird episode.
It's a very weird episode, but we don't rate the episodes. We rate the guest stars. So let's get into statistics and ratings.
Well, as we discussed a little earlier, there were a total of 6 hits this episode, because there were 3 hits in the Kuzbanian section. Dom gets hit on both knees and the head with the hammer. And then he also gets hit 2 hi-yahs and 1 kick from Piggy. So that's the total of 6. There's no explosions this episode. There's
much to your chagrin.
Yeah, there should have been at least one. And there's 1 human Muppet kiss and 1 kissy-kissy, which I haven't traditionally counted, but I'm starting now.
That's right.
Because this is our first of the season, I believe. As far as music goes, this is our least musical episode of the season. There was 10.2 minutes of music for our first under 40% percentage. This season at all.
Oh, there was none last season that was under 40.
No, there were some last season, so let me change tabs. Harvey Korman was 29%.
So, significantly less.
Peter Ustinov was 30%.
Hmm.
Florence Henderson was 32%. Avery Schreiber was 33%. So, lots
yeah,
under 40.
A good 40. Handful under 40 in the last season.
But this season so far, it's been 41 and above, but this episode is 38.61% music. As far as ranking, I like Dom DeLuise a lot. I thought he had fun in the segments that he was in that weren't backstage. He was engaged the whole time. He was very believable in his disagreement with Piggy in the backstage thing, even though it wasn't necessarily funny and it was very fat shamey, so therefore doesn't hold up. But it was believable that they didn't like each other in that moment.
And none of the problems we sometimes have with performers where they aren't quite sure where to look or how to engage, so good at the physicality of being with the Muppets in the way in which I never doubted that he was thinking of them as people.
Yeah, exactly. And having a great time. One of my other complaints is there was no section where I felt like he was just doing shtick, like his own personal shtick. Everything that he did in this show, I felt like was for the show. So, again, not knowing the rest of the season yet, I put him at 4.
That's what I was going to guess. I mean, I predict he may not stay there, but I doubt he'll drop below 6.
Yeah, he was great. I really, really liked him. Which also makes sense because one of the reasons why he's most famous is, like, the outtakes in credit sequences. Clearly, one of the reasons why Burt Reynolds must have liked having him around was because he was always being a cut-up. He was always being fun, even when he didn't have to be. So it was just fun to watch him. So I really liked it.
Well, speaking of things that we liked, we end the episode, as we always do, by going through our top 5 favorite moments in the episode, not complete sketches, but pieces of writing, performance, or production that we want to highlight as we bring a close to our discussion on this particular episode. Pete, what's your first of our 5 moments?
Since I just sung Dom's praises, why don't I continue doing so? And talk about in the Shepherd's Institute of Animal Protection. The whole thing is great, but there's a moment when the chaos is really going on. He's just doing whatever he can to make sure that these animals are happy, even though they're not.
Is this before or after the ukulele gets smashed?
Just before, I believe.
Okay.
There's an odd cut. He's on one side of the stage, and then all of a sudden he's on the other side of the stage, and he has a shovel filled with kibble.
Yes!
We love them with all our hearts. We do. Just a moment, Dad. Open wide.
And he just hucks it across the stage, trying to get as much into that Muppet's mouth as possible. And it made me laugh so hard, because it works so poorly.
It's an excellent example of haste makes waste in terms of I'm trying to do all the things. I'm trying to keep everybody happy, so I'm going to feed him, but basically fail in what I'm doing.
If that were Dick Cheney, a man would have been shot in the face. Because that's basically the method he's going with of just, I'm going to throw this and hope some lands.
Ah, the old kibble shotgun method of pet management. Since we're talking about Dom DeLuise, I will, for the second moment, talk about, in the Myrtle Adopt section, a quirk of the subtitles. We already talked about the fact that they had no idea what was going on with the courts. They also have no idea what's going on with Myrtle Adopt. In that, during the final moment, the reveal, where Dom comes up with the furry cone head that's been added that shows that he's been indoctrinated into the Kuzbanian species.
Myrtle Adopt!
The subtitle for that is Mumbles, in square brackets.
On the DVD, not on Disney Plus.
Correct. And I'm just like, oh, well done, DVD. You blew it. You done blew it.
That's so wild to me that with the idea that this is a thing that they are producing, that the Henson Company / Disney, depending upon when the DVDs came out.
Yeah, I'm sure it was Touchtone Video.
Was okay with getting that transcript and being like, no, he says the thing that we've already written out a million times. Because on Disney Plus, it's right.
They just made it just fumble at the final punchline. The button of that is just not there.
Well, I'm glad you're talking about Myrtle Adopt, because I'm going to continue talking about Myrtle Adopt. You mentioned it earlier, but the moment when Dom DeLuise pulls his arm out of the hole and it's longer than his other one.
It's
the physicality he uses to make that quote-unquote believable.
Where he's got sort of one shoulder hunched and the other one making his arm limp down by his side.
Yeah, is so good. It's not believable at all that that works, but it's believable in the way that he's making it look like it works. It appears like one of his arms is longer in that moment.
But also his reaction to it helps sell it. The way he goes, ooh, yeah. And he looks at the one arm with fear and shock. And then he does the whole mime bit of the limp arm that he can't get to work. It's very clearly he's got one shoulder up and one shoulder down so that his fingertips are at different lengths.
But I also think, because I was paying attention to that, I think he's also then shifting his body so his shoulders are level.
They look level because his hips and
yeah, it's not carriage. Obvious that one is raised and one is lower. They're rough. The tops of his shoulders compared to his head is roughly
square.
On. Yeah. So he does a really good job at just hyperextending his elbow or something while slightly bending the other one. I don't know, but I love it.
He's a very good physical comedian. He's a very good vocal comedian, mm-hmm. which is additionally why it's hilarious that he's one of the best bits of silent movie. but this, I think that this sketch is the... It's the chef d'oeuvre of the... It's the au bon pain of...
on both pronunciations.
Of this particular episode. But I'm not going to go too much further with that. I instead want to, in a show where I've picked at some of the writing a little bit here and there, saying, that wasn't the best they could do, I want to point out a particular phrase that I thought was fantastic, which is, at the end of the interactions between Scooter and Piggy, where Piggy has threatened Scooter because he's made some cutting remarks that lead her to believe that he's not fully supporting her in her drive to get Kermit's attention. The threat of violence gets Scooter to say the following phrase, which is,
I'll go write some more spontaneous, sincere fan mail for you.
And it's basic level irony, and yet it was still a wonderfully constructed sentence. And I just wanted to shout out, well done, writer team. That line is perfection.
For my final moment and our final moment of the show, I'm going to talk about the final moment of this episode.
Huh.
Because we haven't talked about it yet.
Well, that's why you're going to talk about it, or because it's actually one of your favorite moments?
It is one of my favorite moments, and it's coincidental that we just glossed right over this. But in the Statler and Waldorf button that mm-hmm. closes the show, and it's literally the last thing that's on the screen is my moment, but let's talk, let's recap what they say.
Yeah, let's set up the scene since we haven't talked about it yet.
Statler says, I wouldn't mind this show if they just got rid of one thing.
And Waldorf says, well, what's that?
And Statler says, me, and then laughs. But then, and this is my moment, he looks over the edge, but not the way they've looked over the edge previously this season. It's like he's looking out instead of down towards the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's like into the middle distance, but slightly down. And I don't know how a Muppet can make this look, but he looks a little forlorn. Like, he just burned himself and is just like, oh... It conveyed in that not even half of a second moment so much emotion to me, and it made me laugh as it faded to black or cut back to Zoot to do the last blat. And I loved it. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast as Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All the excerpts in this podcast are used for the purposes of review. There are things, dates, facts, names, insignificant fruit baskets, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via via the website, and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible. Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host
is Ben. We want Piggy! We want Piggy!
And we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 6, guest starring Nancy Walker. Yay!